Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
This summer, I'm shopping the small space solutions that America waited 250 years for at Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has everything from retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, party-ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish and space-conscious Bobopedic sofas to feature-packed power recliners that let me kick back all summer long. So, when you're ready to snag latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed and the Unrestricted Area podcast on the Basketball Intelligence Network. We are once again doing a No Ceilings Basketball Intelligence crossover pod. So I am here with one of my No Ceilings colleagues and one of my Basketball Intelligence colleagues. So first of all, Nathan Grubel from No Ceilings. Nathan, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing well, Nick. I'm excited to be back on the show and talk a little NBA stuff with you. We've been so focused on covering the draft over at No Ceilings. It's really fun when I get to let a little bit of my inner fandom out. The NBA is where I obviously started as a basketball fan and a lot of growing up and learning more about the game. So anytime I get to talk NBA hoops with you, it's always a pleasure.
Well, fortunately and unfortunately, we will not be touching too much on either the Philadelphia 76ers, or we will be spending a little bit more time on the Sacramento Kings. So Nathan will be able to get some jabs in at both of us on the Sacramento Kings front. But as I mentioned, I am also here with Ray LeBeau, founder and curator of the Basketball Intelligence newsletter, available at basketballintelligence.net for the Unrestricted Area guest on the podcast, you know, for the crossover part of the experience. Ray, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing well, thank you, and thanks to Nathan for joining us today. And I'm going to ask Nathan to start us off. What we're going to talk about today is players from last year's draft year or draft class, however you want to look at it, who we still have reasonably high expectations for, but who didn't really get, for one reason or another, an opportunity to display why that is. And these are players that either missed the entire season because of injury or went to such good teams that there was no finding of minutes for them, or perhaps they arrived with some development issues that are kind of obvious and we know they're going to get there, or we anticipate they're going to get there, but they're not quite there yet. And so we have expectations, regardless of which category they fall in, for each of them, and a discussion of what this year was like for them and what we should look forward to. And we'll start with Nathan. And Nathan, if you can start us off with Nikola Topic, a player who is on a team that's in the finals, but he's an observer this year. So why don't you start us off with him?
Sure. I mean, we haven't heard his name a ton, a lot because he sat out this season due to a partial ACL tear he suffered. I think before the pre-draft process, it was when he had transferred back from, he was on loan for Mega for a lot of his pre-draft season, then went back to his home team in Serbia and didn't get to play too many games for them, suffered a partial ACL tear. So unfortunately, you know, didn't really hear a ton about him in the pre-draft process because he couldn't obviously work out for teams. He wasn't very physically active in participation, but that's a big reason why he may very well have slipped. I know we'll get into some of the on-court stuff, why he slipped down the draft board. But like at one point during the draft process in 2024, he was the number one prospect on a lot of people's boards. He was a number one potential candidate on a lot of mock drafts, but just a lot, like I said, a lot of things didn't necessarily go his way during that process, but he slipped to Sam Presti and the Oklahoma City Thunder. And of course, Sam as one of the best GMs in the league, gets his chance to take a look at him on the draft board and go, I can't possibly pass on a talent like Nikola Topic. So I'm going to take this kid who was a two-time ABA league champion, Serbian league champion, Serbian cup winner, was rated the ABA's top prospect. It was an all ABA league team player. And in the FIBA U18s, he was the MVP of that championship. So it certainly has an impressive international profile, not like the Luka Doncic type of accolades coming in, but a very impressive profile himself nonetheless, coming into the NBA. But what makes Nikola Topic so interesting is that a lot of what we see with the Oklahoma City Thunder is predicated on the dribble, pass, shoot, defend, right? And listen, Topic doesn't necessarily do all of those things really well, but he does dribble the hell out of the ball. He's great getting downhill, finishing at the basket, can finish with either hand, can finish from either side of the basket, strong going through contact, and boy, does he have some passing wizardry that he can really tap into. He was one of those guys you pop on his mega film, and you see some of the passes he's able to make off the dribble, and you go, holy crap, who is this kid, and how can I get him as part of my NBA team if I'm a fan or if I'm working in an NBA front office? So those are some of the best things that he really brings to the table. But when you talk about how does that fit into the Thunder? Every single thing with their offense, especially as we see in the playoffs, it's continuous movement, whether that's player movement, moving the ball as quickly as they do, running the floor in transition. Everything they do defensively is predicated on getting that team running in transition and getting easy, efficient buckets that way. So even at times where you might look at him, you might be a little bit concerned about the spot-up jumper, he's still one of those guys who instinctually can move off the ball. He can cut, finish around the basket like I talked about. He can play off of other guys. I'll be curious to see when he does get minutes for the Thunder next season if he can be used in some ball screen actions like they use Alex Caruso and Cason Wallace in a lot of those actions at the top. Can they use Nikola Topic as a screener a similar way, get him playing out of the short role, finding different ways to get him moving off the ball downhill? Those are some of the things that I would want to look for as he comes into the Oklahoma City Thunder system. But listen, if this guy improves as a spot up jumper, particularly like a shooter off the catch, and he improves his defense to a certain degree, he can certainly be hunted in different matchups. He can be a little flat footed, can be attacked on the ball. But if he improves enough in those areas to the point where he's able to earn time on the floor to take advantage of some of those other strengths I outlined, I mean, he could be a hand in glove fit with what Oklahoma City Thunder like to do.
So I pulled up my final board from last year just to make sure that, you know, just to check myself essentially before I said something particularly out of line with my viewpoint as of 11 and a half months ago, give or take. And I had Topic sixth on my final board. And I think there was a strong sort of consensus reaction among the No Ceilings crew when Topic went to the Thunder 12th on draft night, which was, ugh, of course he goes to the Thunder. Of just, you know, if there's any team that can afford to deal with, oh, well, the guy that we drafted 12th is just not going to play for us for a year, and we're fine with that because we believe enough in the long term. You know, it certainly seemed like it was going to be the team that was the number one seed in the Western Conference with an exceptionally young roster. And even with how well the future portended for the Thunder at the end of last season, I think this year was still, I think, a level above what could have been reasonably anticipated for this team. And you mentioned it with Topic. I think the biggest thing is just how important it is for the Thunder of basically having everybody on the floor be able to handle the ball to a certain degree, be expected to make solid decisions with the ball in their hand. The defensive thing is certainly the biggest weakness for Topic. I think that's a bigger problem than the shooting personally, just given how smart he is. Ball cutter, given what he can do without the ball in his hands, even though his, you know, greatest skill is creating with the ball in his hands. The defense is more of a concern, but he's 6'6", right? It's not like we're talking about, you know, one of those 6 foot maybe point guards who you have to hide on the smallest player on the floor every time. And you mentioned the cross match screening stuff, and something that you know well because we talked about it quite a bit of depth when we did our draft retrospective podcast on guards a few months ago, of how much I love the guards who can throw weird actions in on offense, the guards who are like screen and roll guards like Gary Payton, second like Bruce Brown. And that's not a main factor in Topic's game, but I'm really glad that you brought that up because it's something that OKC could try. And given his IQ, given his passing vision, given basically everything he can do offensively except those off the dribble jumpers, you know, working him into the offense in additional weird ways, given the pieces that OKC has. I mean, you know, he could be bringing the ball up with, you know, four shooters around him, right? He could be, you know, potentially the dive man with 7'1" Chet Holmgren spacing the floor and shooting threes, right? There's a lot of different ways that Topic could be used in any offense, but particularly with OKC, given that he has the size and he meets, you know, the dribble pass parts of the dribble pass shoot ethos, it's easy for me to see a lot of different ways that Topic could potentially contribute to this team going forward. And given that they were pretty close to and or actually record breaking in terms of their efficiency this year, it's wild to think that they have someone who I would have had as a top half of the lottery pick last year, just sort of coming in after a year of riding the bench.
Exactly. And you kind of think about it too, Nick and Ray, like they don't necessarily have another guard on the roster in terms of at a bench spot that's quite like, you know, that's quite like Topic. Like they have a guy in AJ Mitchell who we can even talk about as part of this quote unquote podcast that we're doing, but
they don't mention AJ Mitchell, so kind of ahead of it, but that's fine.
They don't have another pass first type of point guard on the roster quite like him. So him being able to sort of fill a gap and maybe be a different change of speed pitch for Oklahoma City to be able to bring off the bench. Like a lot of their players that they play the most minutes, they play a very similar style and they're all expected to do everything, which like we're talking about with Topic, he is a versatile offensive player in his own right. But the idea of even when we're trying to make a mock draft and no ceilings, we're trying to figure out like what could the Thunder possibly do in the draft. This idea of at some point you would think that maybe they deviate away a little bit from what they've been doing, and maybe they try and find some different answers off the bench to throw different looks at teams, especially when you get deep in the playoffs. It's important to be able to go to multiple things in the well, especially when a team makes a certain adjustment or two against what you do really well. Do you have a counter of your own? Can you throw a look at them that they haven't necessarily prepared as well for or have studied as well at length? And having a guy like Topic, who is much more centric on getting the ball to somebody else, spraying it out, penetrating, getting the ball to shooters. He's not necessarily dancing with the ball like SGA is, looking to score one-on-one in the mid-range and in isolation. It brings a different element and a little wrinkle to their offense that they might not necessarily have anywhere else in the roster. So I'll be curious to see, you know, how Oklahoma City the Thunder handle integrating him into the roster and the lineup.
Well, I have an observation and a question.
Sure.
The observation is, it was interesting to hear Nick say, I think you said you had him mocked at 6, correct?
I did.
He fell to 12. Halliburton, not to compare them, they're not similar players.
Sure.
But everybody had him mocked at 6 and he fell to 12. So that similarity, not comparing them as players, but just a historical similarity. The other thing I want to ask is, do either of you have anything that you view as relatively reliable intel regarding his health now and likely going forward for next year?
I think the comments that were made, I think a number of people were asked about Topic and how he was recovering end of March, and everyone seemed to say that he's progressing really well in his recovery and he should be ready for training camp at the start of the season. So I would imagine he's going to be ready to go. And the question is, does he have a spot within the rotation to come into to play those minutes? Because they're already a deep team as it is. You have a number of young guys already at the guard spot. It's really funny, Ray. Even when we're, like I said, we're trying to mock and figure out who Oklahoma City might take. They have 2 first-round picks this time around if they make both of those selections. Do they go with another guard who could be like the best player available on the board, even though they have like a million different guards? Do they go another direction? How does Topic factor into a lot of this? You know, I'm interested to see whether Oklahoma City might even try to consolidate some of these guys down and make a move for somebody else in the offseason. Because eventually it just gets to the point, like we all know, you can only play so many guys so many minutes, especially when you get deeper in the playoffs. So what I'm as fascinated as anyone to see what happens with him, and that's why I'm glad you guys wanted to talk about him to lead off the pod.
So it's, in a sense, it's like they have 3 choices.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they're getting a lottery pick. I think Brian Windhorst even said that on one of his Hoop Collective pods. Like the Thunder really have 3 first-round picks this year because they get Topic in the mix.
Right.
So, Nathan, you know how much this one hurts me. Ray, I'm pretty sure you know how much this one hurts me as well. But we do have to talk about I think my personal favorite prospect from last year's draft class, you know, not the guy I had number one, to be clear, but the player whose film I think I enjoyed watching the most, and that was Daron Holmes, the second out of Dayton. And he tore his ACL during training camp, and so never got a chance to get on the floor for the Denver Nuggets. And that made me really sad for multiple reasons. Obviously, the primary reason being that I love watching Daron Holmes play basketball, and it was very sad to not get to watch him play basketball at all during his rookie year. But also just because of how wonderful I thought the fit was between Holmes and the Denver Nuggets. I mean, with Holmes, you know, he's someone who's maybe a bit undersized to be a center, but can make up for a lot of that with incredible bounce. He's a great shot blocker. He had one of the more impressive and believable shooting trajectories of any big man prospect I've ever evaluated, starting essentially as a complete non-shooter and developing his shooting slowly and steadily over the course of his three-year career at Dayton to the point where his junior year, he knocked down 39% of his threes on, you know, not exceptional, but decent volume. And something that I've talked about a lot more this year than I have in previous years is the notion of, you know, shooting versatility as opposed to just pure shooting. And the way that that plays out with Daron Holmes is that he was essentially purely a standstill shooter for Dayton. But the reason that I bring up the shooting versatility element is those are the three-point shots that teams would want him to take, right? Even on a team that decided to feature Daron Holmes in the offense in the Dayton Flyers. I mean, he was the alpha and the omega for that Dayton Flyers offense his junior year. You know, the concept was this is not someone who's, you know, going to put on five crossovers, put you in a blender, and then, you know, shoot from 30 feet off the dribble, right? But the kinds of threes that you would want your flex big man, your 4/5 to be shooting, right? Your trail threes in transition, your hitting threes from the top of the key after a DHO or after running pick and roll as a pop big man. You know, he really showed not just sort of how developmental trajectories can look shooting wise, but on focusing on the right parts of the shooting profile, not just, oh, you know, it's fun to do the Steph Curry and pull up from three, but the functionality of the shooting, of what areas am I likely to shoot from on an NBA floor. And he paired that shooting with really great passing for his position and exceptional interior finishing, like, you know, just absolutely automatic around the basket as a lob threat, as an offensive rebound guy, wherever you might want to look at it. His freshman year, his efficiency numbers are insane. He was in like the 98th or 99th percentile of basically every offensive category. That wasn't quite the case during his junior year, mostly because he took on a much bigger role in the offense.
Sure.
But just, again, in terms of sort of filling almost every, checking almost every box you want to check for a modern big man, but also just how much fun it would have been to watch him play alongside Nikola Jokic in his rookie year. I think part of it also is that DeAndre Jordan, you know, all-time locker room guy, clearly based on the contracts he's signed, but I would not have expected him to play 700 semi-effective minutes this year, and I think that's part of why I was so excited for Daron Holmes to potentially come on board. Now, all the reasons that I was excited about Daron Holmes heading in, other than potential athleticism concerns coming off a torn Achilles, all of the other reasons that I was excited about him still apply for Denver going forward. And
sure,
I just hope that him potentially losing a step, which especially in year one off the Achilles, he's going to be slower than he was in college. And hopefully that's athleticism that he can recover. There are reasons for me to want to buy in, particularly the passing and the shooting development of even if he doesn't quite get back to that level. But man, I mean, you know, Daron Holmes is a shot blocking menace defensively and just fill every gap kind of offensive player is really fun in general and particularly just makes so much sense for Denver. So I've waxed eloquent about him because I loved evaluating him. Really hope that he has a very good NBA career going forward. So Nathan, as someone who's slightly more reasonable on Daron Holmes, which would be basically everybody except maybe his parents, what are your thoughts on how he might potentially contribute for next season?
So I wouldn't say that, well, I guess I do have a little bit more of a reasonable take on him. I don't think he's the second coming of Hakeem Olajuwon or anything crazy like that, like Nick wants to wax poetic about him. But I would agree with a lot of what you said about his game offensively. I do think, listen, the Denver Nuggets desperately need any minutes out of a backup center, period. So Nikola Jokic played 563 minutes in the playoffs this season, and DeAndre Jordan and Zeke Nnaji combined for just 70 minutes in the playoffs. Like, when you're out there watching every single one of those Nuggets playoff games, and you're like, you're asking yourself, did Jokic sub out at any point in this game? Like, quite literally, he probably didn't, probably only for like a minute or two, in all honesty, unless they had Aaron Gordon playing some of those backup 5 minutes. But like, that was really their only other option in the playoffs. So if they can get anything out of Daron Holmes, which, by the way, I think they really will, because you look at what does the team have in terms of draft capital and some of the other salaries to potentially go out and maybe trade for some depth, you know, behind Jokic at center. They don't really have a lot of options. They don't have a lot of draft capital. They don't have a lot of tradable contracts. Do you maybe try and look at, you know, Michael Porter Jr.'s salary, making maybe breaking him up into, you know, two or three other players and one of those guys being a front court option? But who wants to take on Michael Porter Jr. at his salary number? Like, it's one of those fun games that we play in the NBA. Yeah, you might talk about moving one guy, but there has to be a taker on the other side of the table who's willing to pay for that contract and think that he's the type of piece that they can bring in and he elevates that roster. So just given where Denver's at, they do need Daron Holmes to be something. This can't be another Zeke Nnaji where he doesn't necessarily provide value for them. They end up paying him and he is a nothing burger sitting on the bench. They need some of these young guys to do something, and I think Holmes, especially offensively, can be that guy. I do buy the shooting touch like you, Nick. I think he can be someone who posts up mismatches at the NBA level, somebody who can take other big men off the dribble. I like that you mentioned a lot of what he can do in handoff actions, and you and I actually talked about that in some of our pods we've done, how special it is to have a big man who can actually put the ball on the floor and take other guys off the dribble. Just any sort of rim pressure you can get from any position, I think the challenges for him are going to be on the defensive side of the ball. I know the shot blocking numbers were good in college, but I think when I had conversations with other scouts, that was the part of his game where scouts would get a little concerned, because he can be bodied up by bigger guys. He's a liability to be scored over in the post. He's a better weak side shot blocker, not necessarily a guy who's going to deflect everything when he's going up against, you know, a bigger center, a more powerful center in the post. So is he going to be that guy who is attacked defensively a little bit in certain pick and roll coverages, especially because, as you said, he's going to be coming back from a serious injury and a torn Achilles. He's going to lose a step or two. You know, is he going to be that much of a liability on that side of the ball to where we don't get to see enough of the offense? But I think one way or another, you know, the Denver Nuggets are going to throw him out there. They're going to see what he's got next year. And I would venture to say that I'm kind of with you, Nick. I think I'm more optimistic about what he can do for the Nuggets versus any pessimistic takes around his defense or him coming back, wherever the kids may be.
You know, it sounds to me like there's a potential there for a lot, because as everyone knows, they did not have a backup really for the Joker. And if he's anywhere near what has been described here, that's a perfect, it doesn't have to be a lot of minutes. And at the same time, Gordon didn't really have that great a backup either. And playing with Jokic, especially as Nick was describing his offensive versatility, there's not a player who's ever lived who isn't better shooting from wherever because they have Jokic as a teammate and on the floor at the same time. So I, just based on what you guys are saying, I'm even more optimistic than I was prior to
this. And Jokic lifts anyone's offensive floor, period. Like, he can make the average player look like a potential star out there. I mean, listen, Christian Brown was one of my favorite prospects coming out of that draft, but with how he's been able to step into that starting lineup and play off of Jokic, his statistical resume, guys, is probably like the third best player from that draft class right now. Like, alongside Paolo Banchero and Jalen Williams, like, that's how good Christian Brown's been. So if Daron Holmes already has this kind of latent offensive potential like we're talking about, why wouldn't that be more enhanced playing off of Jokic, especially if the spot up 3-point shot really can be a weapon for him, especially from the corners? You know, any looks he's able to get easy, we've talked about his cutting was a major weapon of his at Dayton. Like, there's a lot of different ways to unlock him. And because of the shooting ability, even when they go a little bit smaller, maybe he's not the quote unquote five, maybe he's still the quote unquote four, and Aaron Gordon's guarding more of the fives on defense. But when you're looking at that look offensively, he can at least space the floor so that Gordon can still be that roller, that cutter, and he can have the middle of the floor to work off of Jamal Murray or Brown or whoever's handling the ball for them. So I just think there's so many different ways in which this can work offensively, and Denver needs it to work. There's no other way to say that.
Right. There's a common thread here of when Nathan and I disagree on a draft prospect, Nathan is pretty much always right. And Christian Brown, and I was not. And the only counterexample I have is Bryce McGowan's. And, that's literally it. So if Nathan and I disagree on a prospect and you notice that by checking out No Ceilings, Big Boards, or however you might identify such difference, go with Nathan. Unless it's Bryce McGowan's, he's going to be correct. But let's talk about a slightly different part of the program, because the first two players were pretty easy to evaluate just purely in the sense of the reason they didn't play is because they were hurt. And the next three guys we have up, two and a half of the three of them, injury was not a factor. One of them, injury was a factor for half the season, not a factor for the other half, whatever. We'll get to that when we get there. But this was both the most confusing one for me and also I think the most difficult to sort of figure out going forward, which is the whole Reed Shepard situation. And, part of the idea with him when he went third overall in the draft was this is someone who is exceptionally NBA ready, who, despite the size concerns, his defensive playmaking numbers, his steal generation in particular, is so off the end of the bell curve that it's reasonable to project him as someone who at least will contribute defensively. Maybe he'll get picked on size-wise a little bit, but can make up for it with his defensive playmaking and shooting efficiency, again, off the end of the bell curve. This year, Reed Shepard shot 35% from the floor and 34% from three-point range. He played a grand total of 654 minutes, which, spoiler alert, is by far the greatest minute total of any player that we're going to talk about today. However, over 52 minutes, you can do some quick math and realize that's 12 and a half minutes a game. And he also famously spent some time in the G League where essentially he had, 49 points, 46 points? Absolutely ridiculous offensive game and made it seem like, okay, this guy's probably a bit too good for the G League, but despite being probably a bit too good for the G League, he was also not quite good enough to crack the rotation for the Houston Rockets. And, part of that certainly is just the incredible roster crunch around the Rockets. But it's not very often that you see a number three overall pick who part of the billing for them as a number three overall pick was how NBA ready they are. And then they come in and do very, very little in a much smaller sample size than you're expecting. So, Nathan, what are your thoughts on Shepard's outlook going forward with the caveat that Houston seems quite likely for a consolidation trade? And if that trade happens, whether it's by Shepard being traded himself or by players ahead of him getting traded, he would theoretically get more minutes. But just purely in a vacuum, sort of outside that kind of theoretical consolidation trade, where are you at with the outlook for Reed Shepard at this point?
I'm as fascinated as anyone is what's going to happen with the Houston Rockets this offseason. I think there's been a lot of buzz with Milwaukee and San Antonio because of the whole Giannis Antetokounmpo sweepstakes. And is he available? Is he not available? Where's Kevin Durant going to go? But Houston seems to also be a factor in a lot of this, especially with a potential Kevin Durant trade, because they actually have some Suns draft capital that they could get back. Like, you can put a deal together fairly easily that involves, if Fred VanVleet, they get him to opt into his player option, and you put another salary or two together, you put some draft capital in, and you can arrive at a Kevin Durant trade fairly easily, which would certainly help the Houston Rockets, because that offense was not necessarily like bottom of the league bad, but the shooting certainly was not up to par. They weren't bad in terms of efficiency, but per volume, they were among the bottom third of the league in terms of volume of threes. So
certainly getting the gap between their offense and their defense was among the most dramatic.
That for sure. That's definitely part of where I was going to go. So that defense, a lot of the culture that they built under Ime Udoka, like they are ready to win big now. They were a real deal second seed in the Western Conference. I don't take that to be a fluke. I certainly think they're one of the best emerging young cores across the entire league. And it's really interesting how Reed Shepard factors into all this. So I had a top five grade on Reed Sheppard last draft cycle. I felt really great about it. When he was in discussion to go third overall, I didn't hate it. I certainly thought that he could help the Houston Rockets one way or another, and I still think he can help the Houston Rockets one way or another. One of the things that I did ponder, though, at that time, and I got a lot of pushback for it before the draft, if I was sitting there at number three, if I was Houston, you already have Fred VanVleet on the roster. You already have Jalen Green on the roster. You would figure the most optimized version of a man in terms of hitting his ceiling is to have the ball in his hands a little more and being a quote-unquote point forward or however you want to categorize his position. Would there be an opportunity for a player like Reed Sheppard to actually develop as a point guard, someone who would have the ball in his hands, who would be making plays for others, who would be put in a position to create? Because if all he was going to be was an off-the-ball spot-up guy who could offer some movement versatility, you can get a bigger player to do that for you who's also not as much of a potential liability on the defensive end. Would it have been better to maybe utilize that asset in a different way, go after someone like I posed at the time? What if they could have drafted Donovan Clingan and you could have had him as a potential five-man backup and maybe you wouldn't be in the same position trying to bring Steven Adams back? You could have Clingan established on a rookie deal behind Şengün and you'd have essentially 48 minutes at the center spot locked down for you, and then you could sort of figure out some of the other perimeter pieces from there. I think Reed can return third pick in the draft value, but it has to come from, are they going to empower him to have the ball in his hands and actually be able to create from the point guard spot? He did start three games for the Houston Rockets. In those three starts, he was actually pretty good. He was 24-3 on very efficient shooting splits. Nick mentioned his time in the G League actually wasn't that long tenured. He only played three games in the G League. He was incredible in those three games in the G League, but he spent a lot of his time sitting on the bench. So I don't think the Rockets necessarily know right now what they have in Reed Sheppard. I'll be fascinated to see if he gets a little more leash this season, whether they consolidate other places. Could Reed Sheppard maybe be one of those players that's thrown into a deal if, let's say, the Milwaukee talks were revisited and they were able to go after a player like Giannis? Reed would almost certainly be part of that trade. Would he thrive somewhere else? It's one of those things where I think people had a little bit of reservations about him going into the draft, but at the same time, you've heard enough smart people say, if he were with the Washington Wizards this year, what if he potentially gotten the leash to be rookie of the year? Like, that's the type of player I think a lot of people still believe Reed is. And it's very interesting. Normally, you don't see a player in that position ride the bench as much as he did during a rookie season as a third pick. But I think just given how a lot of the rotation broke out, a lot of what Ime Udoka values in terms of finding value on the defensive side of the ball, it was a very weird spot to be in. And I'm curious on your guys' thoughts, like, what, if you were the Rockets, you know, hindsight's everything, but looking back now, would have you still taken Reed third overall, or would have you maybe looked to address another need elsewhere if you knew that, you know, we were going to be riding with the perimeter core that we were, and that's kind of how the season was going to play out?
Well, there's an obvious sort of go-to crutch for me here, which is just, I also had Reed Sheppard top five, but I had him four, and I had Stephon Castle at three. And given the defensive identity of the Houston Rockets, you know, maybe just turning that up to 11 and letting the offense crater even further and taking Castle instead of Sheppard would have been a much better idea. But just, and I want to be clear up front, this is no shots intended at anybody, but if I were to tell you that there was a Houston Rockets guard who played 12 and a half minutes per game, they shot 44% from the field, but just a hair under 40% from 3-point range. You know, they didn't contribute that much on the defensive end, but in their 12 and a half minutes a game, again, they were efficient, particularly from beyond the arc, did a little bit of playmaking, you know, but basically they were in there to shoot and playmake and, you know, again, 44, 40, 83 in 12 minutes a game. You would have thought that was Reed Sheppard, right? That was Aaron Holiday. And that's what confuses me the most about this whole situation, is just that if you were to look purely at the shooting splits of those two players, you would have assumed that the 35, 34, 81 was Holiday and that the 44, 40, 83 was Reed Sheppard, right? And so that's really, the shooting is really where it confuses me. Because again, as you mentioned, I mean, the Rockets were a bottom 10 team in terms of 3-point percentage. And, you know, defensively, again, there was a lot of the concept that his defensive playmaking can maybe make up for the size concerns that he was going to have. But if you told me prior to last season that Reed Sheppard would struggle a lot more defensively than his college film and numbers indicated, I would not have been particularly surprised. If you told me that Reed Sheppard shot 35% from the floor, like efficiency record-breaking guard Reed Sheppard shot 35% from the floor and 34% from three-point range, that would have been what really surprised me. So I would expect things to turn around for Reed Sheppard, if for no other reason than I think that the sample size of this season makes him look like a worse shooter than the sample size of his college season. And given his high school tape, given, you know, his entire profile, I would assume that in the longer term, he is a better shooter than he showed last season. So he might have a better outlook heading into next season than he does heading into this season, even if he plays exactly the same role and just shoots better than he did this past season, which was well below pretty much everybody's expectations.
So that's the thing, Nick, and I'm glad you brought this up, and it's something I've talked about, not just on podcasts with other media personalities, but I've also brought this up with agents and coaches and trainers behind the scenes, where you get to the NBA and listen, a guy like Reed Sheppard's used to having the ball in his hands. He led the state of Kentucky in scoring during his sophomore season in high school. He was the Gatorade player of the year as a junior, and he was Kentucky's Mr. Basketball as a senior. Like, this kid was a rock star in high school. He was a rock star in college, having one of the best shooting seasons we've ever seen from a prospect. This dude is used to, when he's on the floor, having the ball in his hands and certainly taking shots in rhythm when he can expect them. Then he gets to the Rockets this year and not only had inconsistent playing time in terms of actually getting on the floor, but when he was on the floor, he wasn't always getting shots in rhythm. More times often than not, he was actually found for shots, you know, later in the shot clock, and some of them might have been on more contested looks. And as a guard, he also had to adjust to the physicality of the NBA and get used to coming off different actions and approaching offense in a different way. Like, guards and big men generally take the most time to develop and adjust to the league as it is, because the number of responsibilities they have are much more than what wings and forwards are asked to do. So you already have that uphill battle, but then you're not giving him the reps and the opportunity to even find some sort of rhythm in terms of playing time and role and responsibility on the floor. Like, what can you expect other than inconsistent results, which was kind of my beef from the beginning with him potentially being the pick. I wasn't against it from a talent standpoint. I think a lot of us still believe in Reed Sheppard as a player, but was he the right fit for this Houston Rockets team, given what they wanted to do and who they wanted to play? I still don't know the answer to that question. I don't think the Houston Rockets know the answer to that question, which is why I'm so fascinated to see what happens during his sophomore season.
So following up on the notion of role and fit, sure, and size, and so the strengths that he has that you have identified, given the uncertainty of what his role would be, even if you could max out that role to say, okay, sure, we're going to use him more here than off the ball or on the ball, et cetera, and the fact that, you know, at his size, how does that all factor together in terms of, do you have questions of, okay, is he going, can he really be what we classically think of as a point guard? Or are we talking about somebody whose strengths are maximized off the ball, but if that's at least theoretically more, significantly more difficult now that he's facing bigger players, if my question makes sense?
No, your question makes a lot of sense, Ray. And I think so again, his size and his lack of length was one of the biggest qualms with him coming into the draft. And when you actually look back at the NBA's guards and some of the best guards in the NBA, the average positional size for guards, about 6'3", 195 pounds. There are quite a number of guys who are actually underneath that physical quote unquote average for both size and weight and even length to a certain extent. And yet they're some of the greatest offensive players we have in the league. But see, that's the thing. That's the threshold that they're crossing. They are truly elite offensive players. Like you talked about, Ray, they're not just shooters and scorers. They're also playmakers for their teams. They're like, Jalen Brunson can average 30 points per game, but he's also going to get you 8 or 9 assists. So can Reed Sheppard be that guy? I actually think that he can. I think we saw enough on tape at Kentucky about him being a versatile passer, someone who can make the right read with either hand, someone who has the type of vision getting downhill. I think he can be that guy, but will he be empowered to be that guy? Or is he going to become that guy in another situation? Does he have to go to another spot in order to become that guy? I think that that's the answer that we need to find out. And that happens for some guys. It takes some guys going to another spot. Like listen, I just brought up Brunson. I'm not going to compare Reed to Brunson. We're not doing that on this pod. But like, if we're just using an example, like Jalen Brunson was pretty freaking good in Dallas. But he wasn't what he was for the Knicks in Dallas. He was playing alongside another guy. He went to a different situation and was given more of the keys to blossom into what he's become. And like I said, I'm not saying that Reed's going to become Jalen Brunson, but I think if we're going to find out who Reed can be, he either needs those opportunities in Houston or he needs to potentially find them elsewhere. And I'm fascinated by what they're going to do with the whole Fred VanVleet and everything they're going to do in the backcourt.
Well, speaking of unfair comparisons, someone who Ray and I brought up in pre-podcast planning as a potential person to discuss was someone else who was a somewhat undersized guard who was taken with the third overall pick and who did not work out in their first spot in the league, did not work out in their second spot in the league, arguably didn't quite work out in either their third spot in the league or their fourth spot in the league. But by the time they got the Detroit Pistons, Chauncey Billups was starting to establish himself as a Hall of Famer. So, you know, again, I led into that with the whole not to do the unfair comparisons thing. But, you know, sometimes, especially for guards of this archetype, it takes a little bit longer for them to settle in. And, you know, certainly, you know, a plug and play wing is more likely to be able to find a home in their first NBA location than somebody who needs the ball in their hands a little bit more or a big man who needs more time to develop physically. Right. And so that's part of the discussion that we have to factor in. And I don't think it's a coincidence at all that after the two guys we talked about who missed the entire year with injury, the remaining three players that we're covering all have very similar small guard problems. And so let's use that now as an opportunity to transition to the fourth player on our list who, Nathan, correct me, or Ray, feel free, either of you, to correct me if you feel differently, but I thought that we saw a lot more positive flashes from Rob Dellingham this season than we saw from Reed Sheppard. But I think the problem is very similar of their small guards who need the ball in their hands to be at their most successful. And with Minnesota, you know, Mike Conley taking a step back might, in theory, open up more room for Dillingham going forward. And we'll sort of see how that plays out. But really with Dillingham, the concept was, hey, this is someone who can come in and bring instant offense. And it's interesting because in the first half of the year, he basically didn't play at all. And by the time we got to the halfway point in the season, he was at least playing a much larger role. But even still, he finished the year having played just barely over 500 total minutes across 49. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about Dillingham, because again, I was less discouraged by Dillingham than I was by Sheppard, I'll put it that way. And I believe in both of them in the longer term, to be clear. But I certainly saw more encouraging flashes from Dillingham this season than Sheppard. And I'm curious to hear if either of you agree or disagree with that.
I don't know if I learned anything about Rob Dillingham this season.
That's also
completely
fair.
Honest with you. You mentioned the whole minutes thing, but again, a lot of his opportunities were coming in garbage time later in games. Or you did mention he did get some Mickey Mouse March run, and he got some opportunities. He did show legitimate flashes of what he can do on an NBA floor, just like he did at Kentucky. He has that jitterbug speed. He has that incredible handle. He's shifty. He can get his own 3-point shot off the dribble, but I don't think I learned anything in terms of, is he going to be a microwave guard off the bench, or is this guy going to be able to blossom into the type of star to where he's alongside Anthony Edwards and he's that long-term starting point guard option for the Wolves in the future? The Mike Conley thing was kind of very interesting because Dillingham was thought to be the Conley replacement for when Conley fell off the cliff, and this season Conley kind of fell off the cliff. He's still under contract for a few more seasons. So what does that look like for Minnesota? Are they able to reroute him somewhere else? Is he going to a deal? I was listening to the Zach Lowe show, his most recent episode with Michael Pina, and they specifically discussed Kevin Durant trades. And the only Kevin Durant trade that financially works would be if Durant goes to Minnesota for Rudy Gobert, Dante DiVincenzo, and Rob Dillingham. that's how the salaries work in terms of where they're at the second apron. So like if the Wolves really want Kevin Durant because he's Anthony Edwards' idol and they think that he can really help them in the playoffs, does it make sense to put a player like Dillingham into that trade despite what you gave up to move up in the draft to get him, thinking that he can be your long-term answer at point guard? I don't know the answer to that question, but what I do know is that they have a lot of guys that they need to try and bring back who could be going elsewhere. They have Julius Randle, Naz Reid, Nikhil Alexander-Walker all out there. Like, I don't know what this roster is going to look like next season, and because we didn't necessarily learn a lot about Rob Dillingham, I don't know what this means for his future in Minnesota. What I can say is, even more so than the Reed Shepard G League, lack of G League games, I'm more shocked that Dillingham didn't get more run in the G League. He only played two games for the Iowa Wolves. So you had another one of these guys who specifically rode the bench. And I understand that the G League may not always be the best place to foster a new identity or develop certain skills, but it is a very competitive league with real pro players who are trying to put food on the table for their families. And I still feel like if you can give some of these rookies or young players run somewhere and just get them on-court experience and not have them just wither away on the bench, I still feel like that's a great opportunity. And I am even more shocked, so like I said, that Dillingham wasn't one of those guys who got more G League reps.
I'm really glad that you brought up the trade possibilities, because I feel like Minnesota is underrated as a potential chaos team this offseason. Like, you know, they had such a great playoff run. They went a lot further than people anticipated. Certainly the early season discussion of how bad the Julius Randle, Karl Anthony Towns deal went for them. Then both those teams proceeded to make their respective conference finals. So, early returns on that seemed to actually be pretty decent for everyone involved. But there is a lot of weirdness, particularly around the future of the guard room in Minnesota. And, you know, you brought up Kevin Durant, and, you know, that's one element of this that'll be fascinating. But it'll be interesting to see just how much the Timberwolves feel like they need to address their guard room this offseason, you know, given, as you mentioned, the mostly falling off the cliff that we saw with Mike Conley this past season.
You know, talk a little bit further about that issue. I wonder if because of how well they were playing and how likely they were to advance under certain circumstances and with the expectations and the actual reality, even though he did take several steps back of Conley, that this arguably would not be the year given the immediacy of what they were trying to accomplish for Dillingham to get a lot more minutes. And if Connolly, which seems almost certain, is in terms of his career arc, is going to be even less next year than he was this year, even though he's still a good player, he's not Mike Conley anymore.
Sure.
Could that possibly just naturally lead toward Dillingham having a bigger role and succeeding in that role?
It certainly could, but I think the issues that Nick outlined at the top with both Reed and Rob are the fact that they are point guards who need the ball in their hands to make the most of what they're going to bring to the table. If they're strictly off-ball guys in Reed's case, or they're microwave-type bench guys in Rob Dillingham's case, all of a sudden their proposition gets murkier if you don't give them the right amount of touches and put them in the right spots on the floor, because they are liabilities defensively. But I think Rob, much more so then Reed, is a much bigger liability on the defensive side of the ball, because he is a smaller guard. He doesn't have the same hand speed. He doesn't have the same reflexes and instincts on the defensive side of the ball. And I do definitely think that played a lot into why we didn't see him a lot on the floor, especially to start the season. It was because, you know, this, like you said, Ray, this was a team with expectations to win and go deep in the postseason because they did the year prior. And I think a big part of why they made that leap was because of their defensive identity. And I think when you take away from that defensive identity, all of a sudden, it turns very quickly into, if Julius isn't a positive offensively and if Ant's having an off shooting night, you know, where are you going to try to pull some of these levers and mix and match? And are you going to be able to recoup enough and certainly prevent the other team from scoring enough points to make up for maybe a bad night offensively you're having? Like, there's a lot that goes into this, but I do think, you know, I'm much more concerned about Rob's defensive limitations in terms of where he is than I am Reed. And I think that's a big reason why he didn't get those opportunities.
At Vistaprint, we know you've got that idea for your business, like the one that nails the trade show, levels up your brand, or makes your team say,
"We're really doing this."
But an idea is just an idea until it's printed on
signage, giveaways, custom apparel.
Once it's
in my hands, on my team, out in the world,
then it's happening.
It's so happening.
Vistaprint has thousands of products, easy design tools, and real support to turn that idea into something possible. Print your possible with code NEW20 for 20% off your first order at Vistaprint.com.
So anyone who has heard any two of the three of us podcast before will be entirely unsurprised to hear that we are running long, but we have at least made it to the final player on the list. And obviously the final player on this list is someone who Ray and I have a slightly different investment in than some of the other players on this list. Now, it's interesting because in a lot of ways, there are similar problems for this player than there are to the previous two players. And the flip side is, in many ways, it's the exact opposite problem. So we're talking about Devin Carter of the Sacramento Kings. And the reason I say that is because the defense is not the big concern for him. However, the concern for him, and it's magnified now in a way that it wasn't back in January where he first got on the floor for the Kings, was the issue of the Kings not having a point guard following the De'Aaron Fox trade and Devin Carter not being able to fulfill the point guard portions of the point guard responsibility, which is a concern given that he's 6'2". And so I'm curious on multiple fronts sort of how this feels from the outside, because from the inside, I gave Devin Carter a very, very long leash because he was expected to come back from his shoulder surgery sometime between January and March was the original timeline. Devin Carter made his NBA debut on January 3rd. So literally like pretty much the earliest possible day. I think that might have actually been the first Kings game of 2025 on January 3rd was his return. And so the fact that he shot under 30% from three-point range and 59% from the free throw line, given that he returned early from a shoulder surgery, that's not as concerning as it would be to me otherwise. What was more concerning to me was how much he struggled with the game management running the offense side of things. And, you know, granted, his draft profile was not as someone who, oh, this is a pure point guard type, right? Like that was not the log line for what is Devin Carter best at, was game management, point guard type responsibilities. The flip side of that, though, is if he's going to get more than 300 minutes that he played this past season, he's going to have to do a lot better at that point guard kind of stuff. So I'm curious, Nathan, for your thoughts on sort of projecting that and how much of that is wishful thinking of the Kings have a big hole and this is their best bet to fill it in terms of the assets they have now versus how much you think Carter might actually be able to step into that role. And if he can't step into that role, how valuable do you think he is for the Kings as essentially a defense first off guard?
So you watch a lot more Sacramento Kings ball than I do. So I'm not sure there's anything I'm going to tell you on the court from the tape that you haven't necessarily talked about with Ray, but I do want to give you some numbers and I want you to tell me what you think the numbers might be saying, because you illustrated the quote unquote lack of a point guard issue for the Kings. I will not make the joke on air that I've been making behind the scenes with you forever now. I
won't. Please don't.
But so per cleaning the glass, Carter spent 84% of his minutes at the point guard position. So that's 291 minutes. That net rating in those minutes for the Kings has been plus 9.5 points per 100 possessions. Now, a lot of those minutes have been played alongside a combination of DeMar, Malik Monk, and Keegan Murray. So that could maybe make up for a lot of the offensive concerns you have in terms of that's less responsibility on Devin's plate to try and pull some of those levers as a point guard. But next to Keon Ellis, another player who Kings fans would hope to be in the mix for a long run guard spot, they were plus 14.6 per 100 possessions with Carter as the point guard and Ellis as the shooting guard. 124 offensive rating and a 109.5 defensive rating. So I just want to ask you, Nick, like what do you think? You watch the tape a lot more than I do on the Kings. Why do you think those numbers are necessarily telling the story that they are, and why might they be a little bit misleading? Like, what are your concerns when you hear some of those positive numbers?
I was not surprised that they had a good defensive rating with that unit. I was quite surprised to hear how high the offensive rating was, because as Ray is well aware, my biggest problem with the Doug Christie version of the Kings was how stopped up the offense tended to get of like this, you know, the next 3 minutes of plays is just going to be entirely DeMar DeRozan isolations. And sometimes those work out well for you. And sometimes those do not work out well for you. I think part of it as well, you did not mention Zach LaVine in those lineup constructions, and I think that is an element of it. I think the two of them do not mesh particularly well, but really I think a lot of it is just that, I'm not surprised that the defense looked good. I'm surprised that the offense looked as good as it did, because, again, a lot of the problems that I had with the Kings offense the last couple months of the season was just how stopped up the offense got. And, you know, Carter was off ball pretty much most of, like, very, very rarely, even when there were lineups of Carter and Keon Ellis. Keon Ellis was oddly the one taking the ball up the court most of the time, which I would have thought that was even less Keon's game than Devin Carter's game heading into the season, but it was often Keon that was trusted with those bringing the ball up responsibilities. And with Carter, it's kind of a deal of, if he's not bringing the ball up and his shot isn't where he wants it to be, whether that be due to injury or due to him not being quite as good of a shooter as his one season in Providence where he shot well would indicate. I don't know. I mean, that's, again, it's a lot more the eye test for me than the numbers. I was, again, surprised by how high that offensive rating was.
Sure. And he wasn't a prolific playmaker on the ball, but he did also sport a lower turnover rate, which certainly plays into a factor of, look, he may not be this quote unquote offensive maestro at the point guard position, but at the very least, he's not killing you in terms of turnovers. So again, if he can correct a lot of the shot making at levels where we would have expected him to come in, he too himself was coming off of an injury, didn't get a lot of summer league time, certainly missed part of the season to start. But if he returns to form as far as shooting the ball, if he continues to be a low mistake player, he brings value defensively. I think you're looking at enough ingredients there to continue to give him reps as a point guard and continue to let him explore that studio space a little bit the next level. Because like I outlined with some of these other guys, point guard's one of the most difficult positions to adjust to. I mean, Nick, we've watched a player who you and I rated very highly in Portland, Scoot Henderson, struggle to adapt to the NBA as a point guard. He was one of the best guard prospects that I've evaluated in his time with Ignite and prior. So it's a difficult transition for any guard to make. There are certainly a few that, you know, over two or three seasons, there's a few that can translate and pop pretty early, but those are like special players. We didn't project Devin Carter to be one of those guys, but I don't think that necessarily means he can't be a starting NBA point guard. So that's why as many rumors as the Kings are going to be involved in this offseason with a number of guards, I wouldn't necessarily be running to the table to try and make one of those big swings without knowing fully what I have with both Devin Carter and Keon Ellis potentially playing more of that position and getting some more time to explore the studio space.
I'm going to overlay a little bit on this in the sense of, I think it's the normal difficulty that we've been having, or you've been having, or I guess we've been having in regard to projecting the future for these various players. I think the thing that complicates it so much more for Carter is the team that he's on. Look at all the other teams mm-hmm. have some sense of uniformity in terms of where they are in their arc, et cetera, for different reasons. But the Kings, I think the fairest adjective to or characterization to use is misfit toys. And so mm-hmm. That's a team that, if you were going to create a team that, for however you judge the quality of their players, are misfit, it would be the Kings. And to ask somebody who comes in halfway through his rookie year off an injury to try to do that, and I guess what I would add to that is the likelihood with a new general manager inheriting a team that is so misfit, I can't imagine that the team's going to look anything like it looks now. by the time the season rolls around, for whatever, however his approach is. It could be any of a number of approaches. But to come back with this same lineup is, you know, is suicide too strong a word? I don't know.
That's a bit strong, I would say.
Or maybe. But so to me, that means that how do you project, given the likelihood that the team is going to look extremely different? I guess that's my take.
Well, they looked different before the season started last year because they brought in a player like DeMar DeRozan, and then you make such shocking midseason moves and shipping out De'Aaron Fox. You bring in Zach LaVine. So to your point, Ray, if the team already doesn't have cohesion, along with not to mention all these different guys that like to thrive and operate with the ball in their hands when you include Malik Monk, how are you supposed to expect a rookie to possibly know
exactly
what he's supposed to come in and do and the role that he's supposed to play in
the And so what's the role going to be this year? We don't know because we don't have any idea who's going to be on the team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's I mean that happens to a lot of these young guys, though.
Yeah, right. I think it's almost a certainty that it won't look like the roster that exists right now. Why would you do that? I mean, DeRozan's 36 years old. And LaVine, for all his special talents, is not a winning player. I mean, he's never been and the two of them together, gee, did anybody take a look at how they did when they were with the Bulls?
I mean, I brought up Scoot Henderson just a few minutes ago, but if you tried to evaluate him in his rookie context, the whole identity of Scoot's game is to play pick and roll, spread pick and roll, and be able to penetrate, get downhill, and then spray the ball out to shooters. And that first season, he was surrounded by entirely non-shooters in Portland. Now, some can make an argument that he's still technically surrounded by a number of non-shooters. But the point is that
they're building, right?
Correct. They did find an identity this season on transition play and defense. But when you're trying to evaluate a player that you draft in the lottery and figure out where they fit in the puzzle, and you don't have the right puzzle pieces to fit around them or give him an opportunity to fit into a puzzle in the case of Carter and what we've laid out with the Kings, you don't necessarily have a great way to evaluate these guys. And that's why you have to afford them a little bit more patience and hopefully say, if we clarify some things here, we come in, this is our plan for you, this is what we want you to work on, this is what we want you to build towards, then maybe we can start finding out an answer. 100%. I agree.
Yeah. And to be clear, I think I maybe came off as sounding more negative about Carter's future than I am. I think really for me, the part that's throwing me is the defense was very impressive. The shooting, I'm willing to write off entirely. He came back early from a shoulder injury. Of course, the shooting numbers look bad. The concern for me is really just in, you know, the misfit toys element that Ray brought up that we've been talking about for the last few minutes of what the Kings need out of the only, you know, nominal point guard on the roster. Because at this point, he's literally the only nominal point guard on the roster, with Markelle Fultz not technically a member of the team right now. And so then the question is, you know, given that Domantas Sabonis is an incredible passer, but is not someone who can take guys off the dribble, cannot sort of create downhill pressure going towards the rim that way. You know, if you get him the ball 8 feet and in, he can put pressure on the rim, but he's not someone who's, you know, going to be driving the length of the court and finishing himself. You know, I think that some of the transition attack stuff for Carter is very strong, and that element can certainly be a part of it. But I think it's more just the mismatch between, okay, you know, unlike Shepherd, who I'm not sure in terms of minutes next year, and unlike Dillingham, who I'm also not sure in terms of minutes next year, I have every reason to believe that Devin Carter will play more than 396 minutes next season.
Okay, but that's half a season.
Of course. No. I'm just saying it's half a season, and it's limited minutes in half a season.
Yeah.
I expect both the role itself and the amount of playing time he gets, again, barring injury, to be increased. And then the question there is just, can they hope for him to become more of a point guard over time? Or is it going to be the kind of deal of it's just a fish out of water to expect him to be the primary playmaker for a team, and maybe another team is better suited to capitalize on his strengths? Maybe the Kings are better suited to try and bring in like a Trey Jones or a Tyus Jones, you know, kind of game manager point guard type, and build things on the defensive end. I mean, you brought up Portland, Nathan, as you and I recently wrote about over on No Ceilings. you know, Portland built a very strong defensive identity. And with Keon Ellis and Keegan Murray as sort of your stalwarts, that's something the Kings could, in theory, trend towards. They just need a whole lot of trades to get there. And I think ultimately the unfortunate part is, in the context of this podcast, Devin Carter is almost certainly going to have a bigger role next season. And it'll be fascinating to see what that role looks like. But it could look like a lot of different things. And some of them, many of them, could be a lot more heaped on Devin Carter's shoulders than is entirely deserved. Not to say that he can't live up to it, but just that it's going to be unfair to expect him to live up to it.
100%. And to kind of close us out here on the Carter thing, like, let me be very clear. I'm not disagreeing with you, Nick, that he doesn't have things he needs to work on as a point guard, because as you laid out, he definitely does. I mean, a lot of the buzz I was seeing on social media when people would bring up the Kings and their situation at point guard was, you know, I would be the guy to raise my hand and be like, you just drafted Devin Carter in the lottery. And people would be like, but Devin Carter is not a point guard. I'm like, what do you mean he's not a point guard? Like, I get it. Like, he ran 52 pick and roll possessions, including passes this year per Synergy. Shout out our great friends at Synergy, and rated in the fifth percentile on those possessions for the Kings. But going back to Providence last season, he ran 283 pick and roll possessions, including passes, and he was rated in the 88th percentile. Shots out of those possessions, 45% from the field, shots created out of those possessions. So all I'm saying is we don't know enough about Carter to properly categorize him as whether he's a point guard or not. I think the pedigree that he developed into, especially during his junior season at Providence, growing from, you know, when he was an all-ACC freshman at South Carolina, he transferred to Providence for a sophomore year, really got to blossom more with the ball in his hands at Providence in his third year under Kim English. I think there's a lot of room for him to still grow. And if I'm looking at those numbers, I'm trying to figure out what can I do a little bit more differently to maybe accommodate that player and get that player more comfortable in the NBA versus just maybe I see these results from a very, very, very small sample size and I just dismiss him. I think that would be dishonest for Kings fans or anyone in the organization to do based on a very small sample size like that.
All right. Well, again, as I mentioned earlier, we've run quite a bit longer than anticipated. But before we go, Nathan, Ray, anything else either you want to add before we wrap this one up?
I'm just going to say thank you to you guys, especially as a guest. Nathan, I'm very pleased that you agreed to share your views with us on this subject.
No, I appreciate you guys for having me. Like I said, it's always awesome when I can chop up NBA hoops and get to talk about a lot of guys who, you know, Nick and I have had a lot of fun evaluating them at No Ceilings coming into the draft. And it's really awesome to be able to follow a lot of these players' stories as they're developing in the NBA and trying to figure out what has worked, what hasn't worked, what are some of the lessons we can learn for the draft. So this type of content is valuable for both fans of the NBA as well as anyone trying to do evaluations for the draft.
All right. Well, that is going to do it for us today for our crossover podcast for the Unrestricted Area and the Deep Dives podcast on the No Ceilings NBA feed. Thank you, of course, to Nathan Gribble as our special guest from the No Ceilings side of things. You can find him across all social media at Draft Deeper, and you can find his written work over on NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find Ray on social media at Ticket Rules and at Ray LeBove on Twitter, at RayRayL on Blue Sky, and you can, of course, find the Basketball Intelligence newsletter available at basketballintelligence.net. You can find me on social media at NBA Johnson on the ghost of my Twitter profile and the slightly more active but essentially still ghost of my Blue Sky profile at NBA Johnson. If you've been enjoying the Deep Dives podcast, please leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. Please also do the same for the Unrestricted Area podcast. And if you have any feedback regarding the Deep Dives portion of the No Ceilings NBA podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via the aforementioned semi-active social media platforms or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Nerd!
guys.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ever Google a money question and end up 12 tabs deep with 12 different answers? This podcast is your shortcut back to clarity. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast breaks down financial decisions with a team of trusted journalists. They explain the why behind decisions like investing, home buying, and choosing credit cards with clear, research-backed insights. No jargon, no misinformation. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.